Okay, good morning, Chem 30 A class. It is Tuesday morning, November 24th, 8 o'clock, and we're doing the radioactivity worksheet today. So this is activity number 24, and let me start a screen share just real quick. And what we're looking at today, if I can get back to the right app over there, there we go, is we're doing activity number 24. So this is the radioactivity worksheet, and it's live in Canvas now. It's been published. Let's see if we can open it with preview and just take a look and see what this activity looks like. Let's see if I can drag this thing off the menu bar off a little bit. There we go. So activity 24 is all about radioactivity. So these are radioactive isotopes that are going to be giving off different types of emissions. And we're going to be looking at how do we actually write radioactivity equations. And so one of them Krista had written in here, we'll work on these two. And we'll show how to go through and do half-lives and how to calculate how much of the material is remaining. These that are more definition, fusion, fission, the sources of naturally occurring radioactivity and radioactive isotopes, I'll let you look those up in the textbook under definitions. Those are a little bit easier to do. What I'll really focus on is really the equations of how do we write these types of equations and how do we deal with half-life calculations. So those are the two things that I'm really interested in getting you, getting for you today. So let me stop that share. Let me go ahead and share the screen for my iPad. This takes just a second to switch it over. Okay, showing me a green box, showing me that we are live. So this is activity number 24, radioactive worksheet. And as we start this, one of the good things to understand first is where does radioactivity come from and why, what is radioactivity? How does this actually work? Well, there's several things to understand about isotopes. When we look at an atom, just want to remind everybody that the first thing that we know about an atom is that we have the electron cloud, which is on the outside here. And that electron cloud, all of the chemistry that we've been looking at so far has to do with that electron cloud. And when we look at that, the nucleus that is inside is very, very small, but the nucleus contains the protons and the neutrons. The protons being positively charged and the neutrons being neutral. And everything having to do with radioactivity has to do with the nucleus. So while we've been looking at chemical reactions and we've been looking at the valence electrons and how the valence electrons interact in the formation of cations and anions and polyatomic ions, all of that stuff all had to do with the electrons. Now we're looking at the nucleus and the protons and the neutrons. And as we look at the protons and neutrons, what we find is that there is a ratio between the protons and neutrons. And if we look at that ratio and we look at the number of neutrons and we look at the number of protons, that what we find is that there is an island. It sort of looks like this, that expands out a little bit in the middle where we get ratios that are stable ratios. And then there's another little bitty spot out here that's away from it that gives stable ratios as well. And everything else outside of this is unstable. So if we have out here too many neutrons, this becomes unstable. And too many protons, this becomes unstable. And these elements, in order to be able to fall back into a stable ratio, What they do is they give off a particle, a piece of the nucleus. So this is a loss of a particle. Part of the nucleus. And in so doing, it falls back into a stable ratio. Or over here, if there's too many protons, then the nucleus gives off a different type of particle. And then it falls back into the stable ratio. And so what we find is if we look at this, that when we look at light particles, light weight, small particles, atoms typically have a ratio of protons to neutrons, which is approximately one, sort of a one-to-one ratio. For large particles, large elements, number of protons greater than 84 tends to be unstable. So when we get protons up to 84, we can get stable elements, but above 84, they tend to become unstable. Even number of protons are more stable than odd. And all isotopes with the protons greater than the neutrons are unstable. Where the number of protons are greater than the number of neutrons are unstable. And by unstable, when we use that word unstable, that means that these elements are radioactive. And by radioactive, that means that they give off a particle. So what are the types of radiations that we see as we're looking at these things? Here we've got the types of radiation. The first type of particle that we look at, so this is the particle type, is alpha. So a lot of these are done by symbol. So we have alpha. An alpha particle is a helium 4-2. And remember that the number up here, this is the mass number. It equals the protons plus the neutrons. And the number down here, this is the atomic number. Let's be consistent. This is the atomic number and is simply the number of protons. So this is a helium atom that has two protons and two neutrons. This is a low energy type of particle. And in terms of energy, the higher the energy of the particle, the faster the particle is traveling, and the more mass the particle can travel through. So when we look at sort of a mass of material, and we look at solid material, because of the low energy of the alpha particle, the alpha particle, helium 4-2, can penetrate just millimeters into a solid material. And before it hits something and stops and is absorbed, that's how low energy it is. Generally, people who are working with alpha particles, they wear lab coats, they wear gloves, and those lab coats and those gloves are sufficient to be able to block this particle from reaching the skin. So this is stopped by lab coats and gloves. And these types of radiation, when we look at these types of radiation, maybe I should stop for a second and push this down in the notes and do just a little bit more talking about what radiation does and why radiation is dangerous before we get into these different types. So radiation is also called ionizing radiation. When these particles hit an element or hit a molecule, let's say that this is a molecule that is constructed of X and Y, and this is the radiation particle. What happens is it typically fragments the bond here. It will cause the bond to cleave, and it will usually cause the bond to cleave in such a way that electrons will fragment either homolytically or heterolytically. So there's two different options here. One option, the first option that we're showing here is heterolytic. And it produces X plus and Y minus. These are ions. And so ionizing means that it takes a neutral molecule and produces ions. That's what ionizing radiation means. When that happens within your body, the way that that happens within your body is that there are many different types of things that that radiation can hit, but one of the things that that radiation can hit is your DNA. So as we look at DNA, which is a set of base pairs and instructions for encoding all of the proteins and the way that your cells reproduce, when ionizing radiation comes in and hits the DNA, it does the same thing. It cleaves the DNA. And in cleaving it, it cleaves it in such a way that it cannot easily be repaired. The DNA then is fragmented and loses a chunk of the DNA. And so we get a piece here that comes off that is positively charged, and another piece of that DNA that continues that is negatively charged. The other strand is still here. But this is damage to the DNA that is not easily repaired. That damage to the DNA then causes replication errors and coding errors that causes different types of cancers. So we get replication errors. And coding errors. In which case the cell can't reproduce properly or can't produce the proper proteins, sometimes causing unregulated cell growth, which is what cancer is. So this can cause unregulated cell growth. Which equals cancer. And so these types of ionizing radiation can be damaging. Now, this isn't the only type of damage it can cause. As we said, it causes coding errors, so it can also cause just cell death. Or it can cause an error in the types of proteins that the cells are producing. So all of these things are possible when we get damage to the DNA. And that's why we're concerned with how far does this penetrate into the skin? And what type of protective equipment do we need to prevent that ionizing radiation from harming us as individuals? So those are the things that we're looking at here. So we have the types of radiation now. We've done alpha particle. We've shown that that alpha particle is actually a helium atom that gets kicked out of the nucleus. So when we're looking at these things and these types of radiations, what we're really looking at is taking the atom, looking at the atom and the nucleus of the atom, and the type of particle that comes off of that nucleus out of that atom. And so the first particle is a helium atom, can actually be ejected out of larger elements. And of course, the nucleus then changes, and the element that results actually changes. So we'll see that this results in a new atom, a new element actually, that is a smaller element, plus we get some particle. So those are the types of reactions that we're going to be looking at. So we've done alpha. Let's take a look at beta. And there's a couple of different types of beta particles. So beta particles are given the symbol B, and this is beta. A beta particle looks like this. It is a 0e-1. So what does this mean? This is actually an electron. And the type of radiation that this is that comes out, this is a neutron that was 1, 0. And this neutron fragmented to give a proton 1, 1, and it kicked out an electron. So this is a proton that is undergoing change, excuse me, a neutron, which is undergoing change into a proton. By loss of a negative particle. So in other words, this proton kicks out, excuse me, this neutron kicks out, it was neutral, kicks out a negatively charged particle and becomes positively charged itself, becomes a proton. So this is one type of beta. We also have a second type of beta, which gives the symbol beta positive. This is called a positron. And in this case, what we have is we're losing a particle which looks like an electron, but is positively charged. In this case, it's the actual reverse of what's above. It is a proton that is undergoing emission, becoming a neutron, and it's losing a positron. So this is a proton changing into a neutron by loss of a positron. A positive electron. So these are the two different types of beta particles, and these are much higher energy. So both of these are much higher energy than an alpha particle. These can penetrate body tissues and go all the way through. So these will pass entirely through the body, causing ionization of tissue. These are stopped by lead. So we'll say only by dense materials, such as a lead shield. Okay, and then after beta particles, we go to gamma. Now gamma are actually not a particle. So when we look at gamma, and this is the symbol for gamma, gamma is actually a packet of energy. So we call it a gamma ray. And this is just energy. It has no other symbol or particle symbol that I can show you. It's an energy packet that travels in waveform. And in waveform, it's very, very high energy, and it's stopped only by very, very thick lead. I mean, we're talking about many meters of lead that can stop this. So it is very high energy. And it is only stopped by many meters of thick lead. Okay, so that's our gamma ray. So let's look at some examples, equations of how these actually work. So nuclear equations. So in nuclear equations, let's first look at some that are alpha. In this case, we have uranium, which is 238. And I'm going to remind you how to write these equations. And I need to bring in, I'm trying to think about how I want to bring in the periodic table. Let me grab a periodic table just so that we can see that and review that real quick. Come on. There we go. So that should drop it on the page below. Not bad. All right, let's find uranium. Here's uranium here. This is element number 92. So notice that within the uranium, there's nothing here that tells you what the mass number. There's nothing that tells you how many protons, excuse me, how many neutrons there are. The number of protons is told by the number 92, but in terms of the number of neutrons, the isotopes need to be told to you. So there's nothing on the periodic table that tells you how many neutrons there are in order to be able to get the mass number. So when we're working with uranium, this part up here has to be given to you. And I'll say provided in some way. And there's some other ways that we can provide this number to you. But the number that is down below, 92, the number of protons, this is the atomic number. And this comes off the periodic table. So uranium, when uranium undergoes radioactive decay, it kicks out, so all of these that we're going to do right now, these are all alpha particles. So this is going to give me a 4, 2 helium. And then it becomes a new element. And I can tell what element it becomes because we can think of this as an equation where this number here must add up to this number and whatever number comes next. So the mass number, if I take 4 away from the mass number, it becomes 234. So this equals 238 minus 4 equals 234. And that's how I get to the mass number for this new element that we're going to look up. And here, the same thing, 92 subtract 2 has to add up to this number. So this is 92 subtract 2. That's going to equal 90. And this is going to tell me here what element this is going to become. This is the atomic number of the new element. And this one is the mass number of the new element. So now we can go to the periodic table and we can look up element 90 and see what element 90 is. So we started here at uranium. We fell back to thorium, TH, element 90. So this element here is thorium, TH. And that's the element that it becomes. So when we write this, this is the work that is done to produce these numbers, but we don't actually show this work. This part is just us doing the work in order to be able to show what's happening here. So the actual equation would look like this. Uranium 238, 92, goes to form helium 4, 2, plus I also get thorium 234, 90. And that would be the whole equation. Now notice that what's happening is the amount of mass that is on this side of the equation is equal to the amount of mass that is on this side of the equation. This equation is balanced. And I have the exact same amount of mass on each side. And that is due to the conservation of matter. That we've been following all the way along. We've always known that we've had the conservation of matter and that chemical equations need to be balanced. Well, when we look at that balance and we look at how many total numbers of protons and neutrons and everything that's on both sides, this side had 238 combination of protons and neutrons. This side has 4 plus 234, that is 238 as well. So when I look at the total number of protons, it is and neutrons is 238 and 92. Number of protons, this side is also 238 and 92 in terms of its combination. And so that's how I balance these equations, is these equations are balanced by looking at the number of protons and neutrons and the number of protons and making sure that this side sums to the same number as what's happening over here. So these equations are all balanced. Let's do another one. Let's do aramecium. Aramecium is the element that is found in smoke detectors. Aramecium is element 241, excuse me, element number 95 with a mass number of 241. And it also, also undergoes an alpha decay. So 4, 2, helium. And then we can figure out what element this becomes. So it's easy enough to say, all right, 241, subtract 4, that's going to take me to 230, what do I need here? Not 8, but 37. And 95 subtract 2 is going to be 93. And now I can look up what that element is on the periodic table. So that element number 93 on the periodic table is neptunium, NP. And so that's the element that this becomes. So right now in your smoke detector, which is really cool, if you look up at your ceiling and see the smoke detector in the room that you're sitting in. That smoke detector has a small amount of aramecium in it. And what it does is it decomposes into helium and neptunium. And that helium then goes through and ionizes a little bit of smoke, if there is smoke in the room. The ions produced from that smoke are detected by a little ion detector within the instrument. And if it does detect those ions, then the alarm triggers and tells you that there's smoke in the room and likely that a fire is taking place. So that's how those equations take a look. Now let's look at beta. We'll take a look at a few beta equations. One of the beta equations that happens is carbon 14. So this is 614 carbon. This is the radioactive isotope of carbon that is produced in the atmosphere that is used for radioactive carbon dating to be able to tell how old something is. We'll explain how that works a little bit later. But carbon radioactively decays by kicking out an electron. -1. Now, this is not an electron that is coming from the electron cloud. This is an electron that is coming from the nucleus, where a neutron is kicking out a negatively charged particle to turn into a proton. So watch how this works. Same way as before, we must have a balanced equation. So this number, whatever this number is, must add up to these numbers added together. So I need some number that when I subtract 1 from it, I get 6. That number is 7. That tells me what element this becomes. And the numbers at the top, 14 and 0, must add to the same number over here. So 14 plus 0 is still 14. The mass number doesn't change, but the number of protons changes. So here we had 6 protons. It's turning into 7 protons. One of the neutrons is being converted into a proton by kicking out a negatively charged particle. So now we need to go to the periodic table and see what element 7 is. It's nitrogen. So what's happening to this carbon is actually changing by kicking out a negatively charged particle out of its nucleus. It's changing the number of protons it has from 6 to 7, and it's becoming a nitrogen element. Pretty cool. Okay, iodine also does this. This is iodine 131. Iodine is element number 53. It likewise kicks out a beta particle. That beta particle results in the iodine changing from 53 to 54, still being 131 in terms of its mass number. And if we look at where iodine is on the periodic table, iodine sits here at 53, 54 is xenon. So that becomes a xenon element. This is the type of radiation that is most frequently kicked out by nuclear reactors. When there's a nuclear reactor accident, radioactive iodine is one of the elements that is released. Our bodies strongly take up iodine for proper thyroid function. And when your thyroid is saturated in iodine, you cannot absorb any more iodine. So when there's a nuclear accident like that, they frequently give out iodine tablets. The iodine tablets saturate your thyroid with non-radioactive iodine, such that as your body, through inhaling or through eating and ingesting and drinking water, as you take up radioactive iodine, your body then is saturated already and just excretes that radioactive iodine before it can do any damage. So that's one of the isotopes there. We can also look at phosphorus. Phosphorus is 3215. It undergoes beta decay in a very similar way. And it produces 3216. And we need to go and look at what element 16 is. This is where a phosphorus is converted into a sulfur. And that's the last example of a beta reaction there. Let's take a look at the positron reactions, betas that are positrons. We'll need to add a new page. Okay, so now what we want to do is we want to do beta positive. This is a positron emission. In these formulas with positron emissions, we have carbon 11 that undergoes positron emission. This is now a positive electron that is being kicked out of the nucleus. This is where a proton is being converted into a neutron. So in this case, what we're going to get is we're going to get element number 5. The atomic, the mass number does not change. So we need to go look at element number 5 and see what element number 5 is. This is a carbon, which is falling back to a boron. So this is an isotope of boron that it's being converted into. Again, take a look at the numbers and see what's happening here. 1 plus 5 is 6. 0 plus 11 is 11. So these are the ways that these equations are working. Another example of this is fluorine 18. Fluorine emitting a positron, being converted into 18 and 8. This is an oxygen. We can go back and we can look at that one. This is fluorine being converted into element number 8, now having 8 protons. This is fluorine converting into an oxygen element. Okay, so those are our positron ones. And then for gamma radiation, works a little bit differently because it's a gamma ray, it's not a particle. And so when we look at these equations look a little bit different. Technium, TC, has an isotope of technium, this is element number 43, that has a mass number of 99, but they include a little M here. Now that little M looks very weird. This is metastable. Meta being not very stable. What it means is that its nucleus has absorbed energy and the nucleus itself is in an excited state. It has captured some energy, and just like there is structure within the electrons, and electrons can be promoted to a higher energy orbital, and therefore we say that the electron is in an excited state. There are similar sort of energy levels within the nucleus, and the nucleus itself can absorb energy. And when it does, that nucleus goes into an excited state. And so this is an excited state of technium. In this case, the technium then converts not into a new element, it's still technium, but now not any longer in its excited state. And as such, it kicks out a high energy gamma particle or a gamma ray. So this is just a high energy photon. And we call that a gamma ray. So it's no different than any other photon of light, other than that it's just super high energy and out of the visible spectrum. And that energy can pass through miles of lead, very, very high energy radioactivity that is coming out of these. Cobalt does a similar thing. The cobalt is gonna look a little bit different though. In the cobalt, we're looking at isotope 60 of the cobalt. Cobalt's atomic number is 27. In this case, the cobalt turns into a beta particle, plus we get the gamma ray, plus we get some new element. So sometimes gamma rays also happen with the loss of another particle. So gamma doesn't have to happen by itself. Gamma can happen in the transition in losing other particles. So this is a beta plus gamma ray emission. And we will do this equation very similar to that we do all the other equations. We have a zero up here. There is no particle released from the gamma ray. So 60 is going to still be the number that is going to be at the top here. Zero plus 60 is 60. And now I need some number minus one, which is going to equal 27. So that's going to be 28. And now we can look up what element number 28 is on the periodic table. Element number 28 is going to be here. This is nickel, element number 28. So this is cobalt releasing both a beta and gamma to turn into nickel 60. Let's do one more of this type of equation. Potassium is another example. The radioactive isotope of potassium, which is found in bananas. And actually, if you take a Geiger counter and you point it at bananas, or a banana, you can actually pick up some radioactive activity coming out of it just from naturally occurring potassium radiation in the environment. So potassium undergoes also the same sort of decay. It gives off a beta emission and also the gamma, and it produces 40 and 20, and this is a calcium. And so potassium converts to calcium upon its decay. All right, so those are how we write those equations. And when we take a look at the worksheet that we're going to be doing, and I think I have it preloaded here in another spot. Oh, hang on a second. Let me bring it in from here. Or actually, I don't need to do that. Let me just go back to where I was. That'll be fine, because I haven't completed this for you. I have some of the work in here for you, but I haven't completed all of it. What we're doing is we're writing and looking at nuclear equations for the following radioactive processes. Silver-113 undergoes beta emission. This is silver-113 undergoing beta, but to be able to complete this, you need to look up the silver element itself. And so I'll remind you here in this part that there are two different ways of writing isotopes. We have the nuclide symbol. Where the nuclide symbol tells me Ag-113, and then I need to go back up to the periodic table, which is on this sheet, and we'll look at silver and find it. Silver is number 47. So that is going to tell me that this is 47. And the other way that this is often written is silver-113. And so you can see here the mass number given in two different ways. In the nuclide symbol, we always give you the atomic number, but when we write it out in words, you have to go back to the periodic table and look up what that number is. And so that number here is 47 from periodic table. And then you take and you put down the type of emission, and then you figure out what else comes out of this. And so I'm not going to complete that process for you. I'm going to let you go through and do those. Here's the iodine-122 giving a positron emission. So the positron emission, remember that this is positive for the positron emission. Here's radium-226 undergoes alpha decay to produce radon. And so this one I actually have, gamma rays are also a product. So here's an example of radion giving off two different types of particles, giving off the alpha decay, so there's my alpha, and my gamma ray that comes off. Bismuth gives off just alpha decay. And the bombardment of californium-249, so here's californium-249, with oxygen-16 produces seborgium, And so I've written the element symbol for that, 263, plus it gives off neutrons, and we'll have to figure out how many neutrons. So remember that the numbers here will need to add up to the numbers here. And so we may need a coefficient in front of this number of neutrons to get the right number. And the number down here, we'll have to look up californium. Let's go see what it is. Californium is down in the lanthanides or actinides, I believe. Americium. Nope, I'm missing it. So where is that guy hiding? Nope, it's curium. Then it must be up here someplace. I am just totally missing it. Unless my periodic table has an error someplace. Or unless I'm looking for the wrong element symbol. And that could be too. So now I got to go through my name real quick. There it is. It's CF, it's not CA. That's my error. So it's element number 98. Let's go back and fix that. It is CF and it is element number 98. There we go. Now we're in better shape. Okay. So that's the piece that we want to do there. Okay. So we've gone through these equations and we've talked about these equations. Let's talk about half-life now. Half-life is a measurement of how long it takes for a radioactive material to decompose such that only 50% of the material remains. So half-life is a measurement of the life of an isotope. So it turns out that when we look at a particular isotope, we have no idea when that isotope was created, how old that isotope is. And so measuring the lifespan of a single isotope, how long is that isotope, that one isotope going to live before it decays? It's not something that we can do. But what we can do is we can take the material and we can measure the mass initial. And then we can take and we can calculate, not calculate, but measure how long it takes for half of that material to disappear. So this is the mass final. And that mass final is now equals 1/2 of the mass initial. And the amount of time that it takes to do that, this equals the half-life. So we simply take the material, measure its rate of decomposition, figure out when half of the mass is left, and that equals the half-life. And we actually have an equation that governs this. So what we say is we say that the mass final equals the mass initial times 1/2 to the T over T 1/2, where mass final MF equals the mass final. MI equals the mass initial. t equals time, and t one half equals the half-life. The time required for half the material to decompose. And these two must be in the same units. So if the half-life in seconds, then the time would be in seconds. If the half-life is in days, then the time must be in days. If the half-life is in years, then the time must be in years. They just must be in the same units. All right, so some standard half-lives, if we look at some elements, we can look at their half-lives. For instance, carbon-14. Carbon-14 has a half-life of 5,730 years. Cobalt-60 has a half-life that is only 5.3 years. Tritium, an isotope of hydrogen, has a half-life that is 12.3 years. You see that they're all over the map. Iodine-131, the isotope that is released in nuclear explosions. Iodine has a half-life of 8.1 days. Sodium, there's an isotope of sodium, isotope number 24, that has a half-life of only 15 hours. And then, of course, we have things like uranium that we utilize in nuclear bombs and in nuclear reactors to produce energy. And the problem with uranium is that this has a half-life of 710 million years. So that is 7.10 times 10 to the 8 years for half the material to decay. For only half the material to decay, 710 million years. So that means for all of that material to decompose, to no longer be radioactive, you need to go through many, many, many half-lives before the material is entirely gone. So the way that we think about a half-life, visual representation of a half-life. One way to do this is to take and to make a box, a square box. And if we take that square box and we say that this represents all of the material, after one half-life, you would have half of that material left or half that material remaining. So this is one half-life. After two half-lives, so after one half-life, you have one half the material remaining. After two half-lives, let's do it this way. Let's do it two times T one half. After two times T one half, you have a quarter of the material. After three times T one half, now what you have is you have a quarter squared or 16, a 16th of the material. After four half-lives, so this is four times T one half. Now what we have is we have a 32nd of the material. And that process continues going on. So you can think about half-lives. If we think about the equation and we say that the mass final equals mass initial times 1/2 to the t over t 1/2. And we think about this as a fraction, as the mass final over the mass initial. This is equal to 1/2 raised to the t over t 1/2. So we can think about the number of half-lives and how many half-lives we undergo. And we could say that the mass final divided by the mass initial after 1/2 life, where t and t 1/2 are equal, this becomes 1. This equals 1/2 to the 1, which equals 1/2. After 2 half-lives, it is 1/2 to the 2, or 1/2 squared, which is 1/4. And let me think about this one other way. Let me do one more extension. This is 1/2 to the 1, which is 1/2. This one could be thought of as 1/2 squared, which equals 1/4. Or after 3 half-lives, it is 1/2 to the 3rd, which equals 1/2 to the 3rd, which is 2 times 2 is 4 times 2 is 8. This equals the 1/8. And 1/2 to the 4th, 1/2 to the 4th, which is equal to 8 squared. Not 8 squared, I'm sorry, 8 times 2 again, which is 16. So this is 1/16. So the number of half-lives that we're doing here . This would be 1 half-life, 2 half-lives, 3 half-lives, 4 half-lives, and so on. And so you can do it visually by thinking about it as the box and continually cutting each box in half and what's happening each time. You can also think of it as the mathematical formula and the number of half-lives that is giving you some fraction of 1/2 to an exponent and getting a component that way. So when we do problems with half-lives, an example of a problem with a half-life, there's generally a number of different ways to attack these problems, or 2 different ways that I would say to attack these problems. There's a straight up mathematical way, and then there's sort of an intuitive mathematical way. So let's do this. 50.0 milligrams of iodine, this is iodine 131-53, is used to treat hypothyroidism. Hypothyroidism is where your thyroid is producing too much hormone and it causes your body to not function properly. In that case, what they do with a hypothyroid, where the thyroid is going crazy, is they actually, instead of going in and taking out the thyroid surgically, they destroy the thyroid by using a radioactive isotope of iodine. Since the thyroid is the organ in your body that takes up iodine, it takes up the radioactive iodine. That iodine then emits radiation and kills the thyroid tissue. So this is, hit the fast forward button there. This is stored for 32.4 days. If the half-life is 8.1 days, how much iodine remains in milligrams? Okay, so to treat this problem, These are not like our, this is more like a PV equals NRT problem than anything else. What we do is we take and we list out the variables that we need. We need the mass final, we need the mass initial, we need T, and we need T 1/2. The mass initial is 50.0 milligrams. The time is 32.4 days. T 1/2 equals 8.1 days. And the mass final is what I'm after. So my equation is mass final equals the mass initial times 1/2 to the T over T 1/2. I can then take and plug in my values. This is going to be 50 milligrams times 1/2 to the time 32.4 days divided by the T 1/2, 8.1 days. The units of days are going to cancel. And then that is going to create a fraction, which I multiply by my initial milligrams to get my final milligrams. So the way that we do that on the calculator is we take 1/2. Let's do it this way. Let's put it in parentheses, 1/2. And then we're going to raise that to an exponent, which is going to be 32.4 divided by 8.1. That's going to equal 0.0625. And then I'm going to multiply that by 50. So I'm going to have left over, this is going to equal 3.125 milligrams. And in terms of sig figs for these, what we're going to do is we're not going to use the sig figs so much of our time that is happening over here, because that's going to be creating a fraction that we're multiplying by the milligrams. It's going to be more the milligrams or grams or whatever the mass unit is that we're given over here that is going to determine our sig figs. So what we'll do is we'll take and we'll say this is 3 sig figs. So we're going to round this to 3 sig figs as well. And this will equal 3.13 milligrams of iodine that is left after those 32.4 days. Now, another way to enter this into the calculator, depending upon your calculator, how your calculator works, on most TIs, calculators, the way that I would enter this into the calculator is I would say 50, you can use the 0.0 if you want, times parentheses, let's do 1/2, 1/2, close parentheses, the caret key, parentheses again, 32.4 divided by 8.1, close parentheses, hit the enter or equals key. This caret key might also be X to the Y key or Y to the X key. I can never remember what it is. Maybe it's Y to the X key. Might be the key that you have on your calculator. But those are the keystrokes that I would do to enter it in. And you should be able to come out with the 3.125. Let's do one more problem here to demonstrate this one more time. Example 2. In the second example, estimate the age of an artifact that has 1/8 the amount of C14. Estimate the age of an artifact that has 1/8 the amount of carbon 14 relative to C12. Compared to living organisms. You also need one more piece of information. The half-life of C14, of carbon 14, is 5,730 years. Okay, so how does this work? First, we need to understand kind of what's happening here with carbon 12 and carbon 14 in this carbon cycle. What happens in this carbon cycle is that carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, which is carbon 12, winds up being irradiated by radiation from the sun. That photon from the sun irradiates the carbon 12 and converts it into carbon 14. That carbon 14 now is radioactive, but it's in balance in the environment. So it's constantly being produced in the environment. CO2 in the environment is taken up by plants and trees. And so we get trees here that take up that CO2. And as they take up CO2 from the air, they produce sugars, carbohydrates. These sugars then are C6H12O6 and higher sugars. These sugars are enriched in carbon 14. That carbon 14 is in equilibrium with the carbon 14 that is in the environment. Then animals come and they eat these sugars, and they eat the plants, they eat the leaves on the trees. And carbon 14 then is in balance within the environment in all living things, just in the living life cycle of plants and animals. When something dies, say a tree that just dies, that tree no longer is respiring. It is no longer taking up carbon dioxide. It is no longer producing sugars. And so we get this log now that has fallen. And this log has got some branches on it. And it's just a dead log that is now sitting here. This log becomes like a time capsule. That time capsule has now C14 that is locked up in the sugars. And that C14 is undergoing radioactive decay. And we don't need to know the radioactive decay formula for it. We can go back and we can get it because we showed it back up here. So let's go grab that radioactive decay of carbon real quick. It's not that one, it's this one. It's where it undergoes a beta emission to become nitrogen. And so that carbon is undergoing radioactive decay through beta emission to turn into nitrogen. And it's doing so with a half-life that is 5,730 years, where T1 half equals 5,730 years. And so after one half-life, the amount of C14 that is inside this log will be cut in half after 5,730 years. In 2 times 5,730 years, so this is now 11,000 something years, there will only be a quarter of the C14 that is left in it. We can take a small piece of the wood that comes from this and we can inject it into a mass spectrometer and we can measure the ratio of C14 to C12. And we can tell how much C14 is still present in that log. And we can use that C14 to then date it. So what they're telling us is they've given us enough information here and they're giving us the ratio. They're telling us that the amount of carbon 14 relative to the C12 is down to an eighth. And they want to know how many years have gone by. So I like to do this sort of in an intuitive way. Let's take it this way and say that mass final equals mass initial times 1/2 to the time over T 1/2. Well, if I rearrange this equation and I move mass initial to the other side, we get mass final divided by mass initial equals 1/2 to the t over t 1/2. It is this, the mass final divided by mass initial, that is equal to 1/8. There is 1/8 the amount of material left. So that is mass final divided by mass initial equals 1/8. That equals 1/2 to the t over t 1/2. Well, how many half-lives must have gone by for this to equal 1/8 when I take this and raise it to the t 1/2? That is 2 times 2 times 2. 2 times 2 is 4, times 2 is 8. That is 3 half-lives. If we go back and we remember that sort of idea of having that square and cutting that square into fractions, this is 1 half-life. This is 2 half-lives. And this is 3 half-lives. 1/8. So 1 half-life, 2 half-lives, and finally 3 half-lives. Sorry.
Hi, this is Susie calling with the Vehicle Service Department.
What is going on?
We're calling about your vehicle's manufacturer's warranty. We sent you several notices in the mail that you have yet to extend your warranty past the factory cutoff. And this is a courtesy call to renew your warranty before we close.
There we go. Wow. All about my warranty cutoff. And now I'm completely distracted and lost. How am I ever going to recover? Okay, we're back. I apologize. That's going to get cut out of the video. We'll figure out how to cut that out. So as we're saying, graphically, we can think of it this way, and we've gone through 3 half-lives. So that means that whatever is going on here, this is 1/8 equals 1/2 to the third. That is 3 half-lives. That means then that t divided by t 1/2 equals 3. And now I'm into an equation that I can actually handle, because now I can figure out what t is. T equals 3 times t 1/2. T 1/2 was the 5,730 years. So that means that the amount of time that has gone by is 3 times that amount, 3 times 5,730 years. That's 17,190 years. And if we think about this in sig fig terms, they've given me this number without a decimal, so I'm going to say that that's 3 sig figs. I should get 3 sig figs in this number. So if I'm going to round this appropriately to 3 sig figs, then this is going to equal 17,200 years to 3 sig figs. And that is my answer for how many years that thing has been deceased as a time capsule. Okay, so I said that I could show this to you two different ways, and we can show this a different way. The math is a little bit more complicated, but sometimes it's nice to see the math of how do I solve this mathematically if it's not nice round numbers. What if it wasn't this nice 3 half-lives? How would I figure out this problem? Well, we would figure it out exactly the same way. What we would do is we would take and set up the mass final equals mass initial times 1/2 to the t divided by t 1/2. And we start to solve this equation that we still know that the mass final divided by the mass initial equals 1/2 now to the t and t 1/2. This was 1/8. But how do I get to a value which is here in the exponent? to be able to solve this out? Well, the way that I do that is I take the log of both sides. And we'll take the log base 10 of 1/8. And that will equal the log base 10 of 1/2 to the t over t 1/2. Now, if you remember your log rules, the log of a to the b is equal to b times log a. That means that I get to take the exponent and drop it down in front of the log. So now this is log base 10. I'm going to drop the base 10 because now that we understand that I'm just using log base 10 is equal to t over t 1/2 times the log of 1/2. Now these logs, these are just numbers. You can calculate them out ahead of time if you want, or we can save them and calculate them out later. But I'm going to divide both sides now by the log 1/2. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take this entire expression and divide both sides by the log of 1/2. That means I need to also divide this side by the log of 1/2. And when I do that, I will get the equation that says log of 1/8 divided by the log of 1/2 is now equal to t over t 1/2. And now all I need to do is multiply both sides by t 1/2. If we do that, and I'm going to finish it up over here, what I get is I get t 1/2 times the log of 1/8 over the log of 1/2 is equal to time. And now I can just plug in my 5,730 years and take the log of both of these numbers. And I can sort out this equation and tell what this equation is. So let's do that. This is 5,730 years times the log of 1/8 divided by the log of 1/2. And we'll get out what that number is. 5,730 years times the quantity. Let's go get a logarithm. Log 1/8, close parentheses on that, divided by, get the log again, 1/2, close parentheses. And then I close parentheses on the entire thing. And I should be able to hit equals and get the same value. And I did 17,190 years. And so that, again, we would round to the 3 sig figs. And we could write it in scientific notation if we wanted to, but it's 17,200 years, or 1.72 times 10 to the 1, 2, 3, 4, times 10 to the 4th years. Okay. That's how we can do it mathematically with logarithms to go through and to solve the same problem. I think now I've shown you just about everything that you needed to be able to do the mathematical component. There are some other components of this worksheet that have to do with definitions. And those definitions, you can simply look up in the textbook, and they're easy enough to answer just by looking up those definitions in the textbook or even Googling those definitions. But I've shown you the mathematical component and gone through and shown you a couple of example problems of exactly what you need to do to finish out this thing. So I think I've given you everything you need, and we're up against that hour and a half at 9:30. So I think we're gonna call it here. I hope that this has been instructive. I hope you've gotten all the information that you needed. And of course, remember that I've got office hours available today from 10 o'clock to 11 o'clock. And tomorrow, I also have office hours. Tomorrow's office hours are from 1:30 to 2:30. All right, that's everything. Hope you guys have a great Thanksgiving, and we'll see you later. All right, thanks. Oh, of course, there's always the awkward moment of, how do I get out of this? And that awkward moment is prolonged. There we go. Stop share, stop video, and y'all take care.